Yeah. Did you mention the focus of nation of victims?
Yeah.
Is that worth buying and looking into, or is it taking?
It's, I would call it shocking and insane. Yeah, it's insane because it's story after story after story of this sickness in America that everybody gets ahead by treating themselves as a bigger victim. I wouldn't say that the thesis is deep or the sociology is deep. It's just when you pile up dozens and dozens of cases which have been decided by courts, it's a bit shocking. But to have it, you know, as a the thesis is obvious, and people get ahead by saying that I'm a female faculty member on a university claims that a certain picture is offensive to her. I don't know, some classical picture, but as you will have at universities, the women are portrayed as sex objects. Okay, but this is, I don't know, whether it was Chagall or it was Modigliani or Picasso or something. So the bottom line is, it offends her. Well, it can't offend anybody. And the only way you can tell whether the person is offended is to ask him, are you offended? So you nail it. It gives everybody absolute power over the community by saying, that offends me, so you can't do it. You know. Can I say? It depends on what you want the book for. It's not a book that you'll save and treasure 20 years from now. It's just a useful expose of the kind of foolishness that is ruining good sense in our system, in American society. Okay. Brief review. And time for questions. A couple more observations. We're talking about democracy. And really, the subject is how much we're willing to sacrifice democracy. How much we're willing to give it up. So, we had first the fact that if the majority of the society decides to do something that's immoral, so we are not prepared to go with the majority just because it's a majority. And the contrary will say, listen, in those cases, the majority's wrong. And it would be appropriate to oppose the majority. Then we talked about representative democracy. When you vote on representatives and they make the decisions, you are giving up a certain part of democracy. Because in between the elections, the government is an absolute dictatorship. There's no way to restrain. Absolutely. They can't commit certain things called crimes. But other than crimes, the people have no say into what's going on. Only the government determines what's going on. That certainly is not the fundamental idea of democracy. And if you believe in it, not just because it's efficient, but because there's something right about it, then as was suggested, what seems to be right is you get better decisions, smarter decisions, decisions that can look further down the road, decisions that are informed by experts. And that being the case, you're giving up democracy for the sake of more efficient decisions. So we asked, what's in favor of democracy? Why do people feel democracy is so important? And we said two things. One was, there's a root idea. Nobody should push anybody else around. Nobody should tell anybody else what to do. In an ideal world, so to speak, everybody would make his own decisions, and no one could ever tell anybody else what he should do. Trouble is, we don't live in an ideal world, and in order to get things done, we have to cooperate. Everybody knows we have to cooperate. If we don't cooperate, then we'll fall apart. No, we'll have to cooperate, and people disagree. Somebody's going to get pushed around. So the idea is, push around as few people as possible. If you have an election, you have a vote on an issue, and you go with the majority. So on any issue, only a minority is going to get pushed around. It's not nice for anybody to get pushed around, but given that you have an overwhelming need for people to act together, So, as a minority, you're going to get pushed around. You're minimizing that bad, that evil. I mean, let me give you a simple example. I mean, this makes maybe sound too abstract. Clearly, everybody's better off if we drive only on one side of the road. You don't want to have a situation where everybody can drive wherever he wants, because then no one will get anywhere. The car will just be, the road will just be clogged with cars. So let's suppose we take a vote. Which side of the road should we drive on? The right side, like the same people, or the left side, like the British? Now, and we take a vote. Right? And let's say 62% vote in favor of the right side, and 38% are British. So now, we all agree you have to drive on only one side of the road. If you drive on the right, then 38% are going to be forced to do something they don't want to do. If you drive on the left, 62% are going to be forced to do something they don't want to do. It's better to force 38 than to force 62. Since it's bad to force anybody, force as few people as possible. So if you go with the majority, you're forcing less people. That's the value of it, the one value of democracy. Which means that whenever you push somebody around, you're doing something wrong. So do as little as possible. Now, when you have a representative democracy, in between elections, 700 people can tell 270 million other people what to do. So how many are we pushing around? Everybody! Minus 700. That's a gigantic evil. They can tell everybody what to do. How do we tolerate that? For better efficiency. For better outcome. So that means that whatever this business of being pushed around means, it's not the top of the line. It's not the most important thing in the world. Here, for the sake of efficiency, we're prepared to give it up.
Yeah. Using a real-life example from the American political scene in the past few years, do you remember this whole thing with Jim Jeffords? I think he was a Democrat, and then he wanted to go to the Republican side, and by him doing that, tipped the balance in Congress.
Yeah.
So, does this then weaken what the conservatives say, that Jim Jeffords tipped the balance for people, that just because we have this representative democracy in the United States, and because Jim Jeffords is one of those representative electors, when he chose to switch for whatever reasons, for the benefit of the people, or for political parties, whatever the reasoning was, when Jim Jeffords decided that he was going to switch political parties and change the balance of power in Congress, does that weaken the conservatives, saying that this is a backroom deal, this is made without the consent of the American people, this is just the political parties playing games, trying to have power between the political parties and the people are totally... Like, the people didn't have an election to say, Jim Jeffords, you know, you're a Democrat now, the Republicans have better ideas, maybe you should switch and become a Republican, and therefore alter the whole balance of power in the American Congress. I mean, does that take away, does this whole situation take away from conservatives saying, where's the power of the people? You know, this is just Jim Jeffords doing it for Jim Jeffords' good sake, and the people have no say in his switching political parties. Like, am I too far off?
I don't hear the argument at all. You elect a person.
He didn't consult the people who elected him.
According to American political structures, you don't have to consult. You're elected. You're in there by law for 2 years if you're a representative. You're there for 2 years. Next election is 2 years away. Either the people will like what you did or they won't like what you did. You have no obligation to go and consult with anybody.
Because when he did that, all you heard on, like, conservative radio stations a lot in New York, and all the conservatives were saying, like Rush Limbaugh and a lot of people of his ilk, oh, this is a backroom deal that takes away from the power of the people. And you were saying that...
I don't hear it at all. The whole idea of representative democracy is you vote him in, he's in, he does what he does. Next time around, he runs on his record. He'll have to come back to the same people in that constituency. He switched from Republican to Democrat. So they'll clearly shoot him. I mean, nothing else to do with a guy like that. Either they'll re-elect him or they won't. That's the way it always is. You run on your record. And if you're smart, you'll be thinking about what the people at home want. But if you're into political suicide, you know, Carter only lasted one term. He did what he thought was right, and he got shot down. So the first Bush was the same thing, right? He only had one term. He did what he thought was right. He led the country in the way that he wanted to, and he got shot down. So some get shot down, and some don't. I can't hear anything about any argument like that. The other general idea of democracy was that we're afraid of tyranny, so we want to put the control in the hands of the people. And if that makes the government unwieldy and sort of hamstrings it, you have the separation of powers, it doesn't matter. We want to be able to protect ourselves from concentrating the power too much in one hand, and that it should be absolute power, so we want to weaken it as much as is practical. Those are the two supports for democracy that I know of. And what I'm pointing out is that we are happy to compromise democracy when significant efficiency gets in the way, or utility gets in the way, and of course if they make a decision that's wrong, just because it's democratically made doesn't make it right. Any comments on all of that material? You mentioned yesterday. Okay, now I want to do two things. First of all, I want to draw an analogy to the way the Torah society would work. And then, if we have time today and tomorrow, I'd like to reflect on what this means about freedom. How does a Torah government work? What does the Torah say about running a country? First of all, there's almost no democracy. The king is not elected. Sanhedrin is not elected. There are no elected positions. So democracy has almost no purchase. I know of two places where something like democracy applies, but that's it. And they're certainly not at the center of things. One, according to Maimonides and others, is this. This would be a bit surprising, but this is what Maimonides and some others hold. You heard that the Sanhedrin, one of the things the Sanhedrin does is to make rabbinic laws. According to Maimonides, that's not quite right. Sanhedrin does not have the power to make laws. The Sanhedrin has the power to propose laws. But the law is only passed, it's only binding when the majority of the Jewish people take it on and live it. So you can have a situation like this, and apparently it happened a couple of times in the Talmud, where the Sanhedrin gets together and they say, we're telling you to do X. And most people say no. And when the people say no, they're not doing anything wrong. Because until the people say yes, it's not a law. Only when the majority of the people take it on and do it does it become a law. And the people say no, then it's no. And it's not a law. Certain things had to be proposed twice in the Talmud. And the explanation is the first generation, the Sanhedrin passed it, and the people didn't accept it. So it didn't get passed, wasn't binding. And only later, second time around, people accepted it, and then it became binding. Which means that in terms of creating rabbinic laws, you have a direct democracy. Nor is it a direct democracy. It's like a plebiscite. It goes to the people, and the people have to decide whether to accept it or not. Once the people decide to accept it, it becomes a law. Later on, people can't change their mind and say, no, we've got tired. But if they don't accept it the first time around, it's not a law. So that would be a very powerful, direct democratic function. The other thing is, in Europe, now I don't know how far back this goes, but you had an institution called Shiva Tuvei Ha'ir, the seven good people of the community, and they were elected, there were elections in the community, and they collected taxes, and they negotiated with the non-Jewish government, and they organized institutions of society. They play a sort of governmental role. Honestly, I don't know where that comes from. I don't know what the source of it is, but I know such a thing existed. But when we lived in the land of Israel and we had our own king, we had our own country, our own state and institutions, there was no democratic representation at all. And there were no votes on issues. However, we did have separation of powers. This, which is really, I would say, a secondary idea in democracy, but isn't it true, Tucker, that all Western governments have some kind of separation of powers? An independent executive, an independent judiciary? I don't know if that's true, but in America, you know, you have the three branches. And each branch has its own authority, and it, as I told you yesterday, can get tricky if one branch tells another branch to do something and they decide that they don't want to do it. In our legal system, you have three different authorities. You have the king, who has his own authority, something like an executive who can raise taxes and can do public works, and if someone rebels against the king, it's a capital crime, and the king can have them executed without going through the courts. It's a pretty powerful position. You have the Sanhedrin, which is like a Supreme Court and legislature rolled into one, unelected, but they interpret law, apply law, and can, as I said a moment ago, propose new laws. And you have the prophets. The prophets have a certain legal authority of their own, which is independent. So you have three sources of authority, and they can come into conflict. And indeed, there have been times when they came into conflict. So you do have a certain weakening of authority. You have a certain spreading out of the power. So they're not all the powers concentrated in one hand. I don't know how many of you have heard of civil disobedience. See, it's not as popular as it used to be. Yeah, yeah. You don't have any white hairs, but you still remember the Vietnam era. Now, let me explain this to you because it's an interesting idea. And then I have a little surprise to tell you about it. Civil disobedience works like this. You're living in a democracy, and the majority makes a decision to do something. And you or a certain minority feel that it's wrong. Morally wrong. What can you do to express your moral condemnation of what the society is doing? So here's what's accepted. You can break certain laws. Listen carefully. You can break certain laws as long as you don't cause direct damage. Civil disobedience, like sitting down in the middle of a traffic intersection, which we did in hundreds in the Vietnam era. Just sit down, block traffic. And then you are taken off to jail. And you're punished for it. And you get the legal punishment for disrupting traffic. And you take it. By accepting punishment, what you are saying is, I'm prepared to suffer for this. I feel so strongly that what the society is doing is wrong, that I'm prepared to suffer for it. And it is precisely your willingness to suffer the punishment of the law which drives home to the majority that you have a serious complaint. And the purpose of it here is to make the majority think again. Make them think again. Now, there's a significant minority of people, let's say 30%, who feel that what's being done is immoral. And they feel it strongly enough to disrupt things and to take the punishment for disrupting things, then that will stimulate the majority to think more carefully about what they're doing and perhaps change their mind.
The silent majority.
Well, maybe yes or no, but the important point here is this. How, if you're part of the 70%, how do you look at the 30%? You do not look at them as common criminals. You look at them as playing an important role in a democratic society. They're criminals, but they're not common criminals. They've broken the law, the police will arrest them, the police will punish them, and you as part of the 70% will be in favor of punishing them, but you will not look at them as evil, nor as selfish, nor as destructive. You look at them as playing an important role in having a democracy and where people are willing to think twice about what they're doing. Which is not true of a common thief or a drug pusher or a liar or fraud or anything else. Here's a criminal, but the kind of criminal act that the society approves of having available, even though they punish it, because they recognize that it plays an important role in society. Now, this is something which in American political history is very deeply rooted, and has been used over and over again. Continues to be used by certain people. Greenpeace uses that kind of thing all the time. There is a magazine, a quarterly magazine called Azure. Azure. That's really the name of a color. Kind of reddish, bluish color. It is the name of an English, Israeli, conservative magazine, intellectual magazine. Even if, I mean, I hope that conservative intellectual doesn't sound like a contradiction to you. Right? Very well thought out. They have very interesting papers on interesting subjects, religious, non-religious, right-wing. And about 3 years ago, they had an article on civil disobedience. Where does the idea come from? The idea that you can oppose the government and yet be respected for it and be accepted as doing something important, even though when you oppose it, you broke a law and you get punished for it, but it's a respected thing to do. The author said, if you look throughout the ancient world, you will not find it anywhere but one. You won't find it in Greece. You won't find it in Rome. You won't find it in China. You won't find it in Egypt. You won't find it in Babylon. You won't find it in Persia. The only place you find it is in the Tanakh, in the Bible. Because we have separation of powers. So, King David does something, and the prophet Nathan comes to King David on the throne and says to him, you're wrong. What you did was wrong. What you did was evil. God hates it. That could not happen in another society. There's no one with power outside the king who can come to the king with an equal standing and say, no, you can't do that. The kings themselves were semi-divine. The pharaohs, the Roman emperors, were gods of themselves. So this idea of civil disobedience is rooted in the Jewish history, in the Tanakh, and it is based really on the idea of separation of powers. And what I'm pointing out is that we too have a concept of separation of powers, three different areas where authority resides, and they are independent of one another, and it is conceivable for the Sanhedrin to say to the king, you're wrong, for the prophet to say to the king that you're wrong, for the Sanhedrin to say to the prophet you're wrong, for the prophet to say we're disbanding the Sanhedrin. I mean, it's, and then sometimes you can have conflicts which are not easy to reconcile, so there is a diffusion of power in our system. But not democracy, not in the sense of voting on issues, nor in the sense of having democratically elected representatives. That you don't have in Jewish organization of the state. You have a question?
What about Kelowna? Was it part of the French? You mentioned
earlier. I don't know why there's this idea. The priests have no authority. They have no authority. They're just chosen to perform a certain job, and nobody else can perform that job. But let me explain a little bit what authority means. Authority means, I mean, I'm making it very simple, but it's one way to put the idea across. Authority means that when he says so, that makes it so. When he says it, that makes it. A guy's accused of a crime. So the newspaper reporter says he's guilty. And the drugstore operator says he's innocent. And the political commentator says he's guilty. That's all shooting the breeze. But when the judge says, I pronounce you guilty, that makes him guilty. The judge is not giving another opinion. Your guy says he's innocent, I say he's guilty. When the judge says, I pronounce you guilty, that makes him guilty. The words do the job. Right? When the justice of the peace says, I pronounce you man or wife, that makes you married. That's what authority is. Authority is that when you say so, that makes it so. Because you said so. The Kohanim have no authority like that. They can't make something so because they said so. That's God. They can be the ones who can ask, but the question, the answer has to come from God, and that's a direct miracle from God, so that has nothing to do with their authority. Even, well, maybe you do have a case. You do have a case, but it's not, in the case of Tzaraas, Cohen has to see. Over there, it's, there's a little footnote, but it's so interesting. What happens? The person has a blotch on his skin, or on his clothes, or on the walls of his house. So they call the Kohen comes in and takes a look, and he says, Torah Tami, right? What happens if the local Kohanim are ignoramuses? They can't tell, you know, olive from a strawberry. They can't tell colors, they don't know what the laws are, big blotches, small blotches, you know, raised, recessed, they just don't know. But suppose you have an ordinary Jew, you know, just a regular old Tom, Dick, and Harry. Reuven Schwartz. And he knows. He studied the laws of Tzaraas, and he knows them well. So here's what happens. The Kohen goes to the house, or to the person, or to the garment, and he takes along Reuven. And he says to Reuven, what do you see there, Reuven? You see olives, strawberries, and something else, you know, big, small. How does it look to you, Reuven? Everybody says, well, from my 13 years of studying these matters, I can tell you that it is Tzaraas and it's Tummy. And the Kohen says, thanks very much, Reuven. You are Tummy. And when the Kohen says it, he's Tummy. It's the words coming out of the Kohen's mouth that make him Tummy. Only when the words come out of his mouth is he Tummy. You're not discovering that he's Tummy, you're making him Tummy. And here's the proof. The Torah says, and if it's a question of the house, if it's in the walls of the house, before you go and get the Kohen, take your furniture out of the house. I'm giving you a good piece of advice. Before you go and get the Kohen, take the furniture out of the house. Because, you know, if the Kohen comes back and says it's tummy, then everything in the house is going to be tummy. So make sure you get your furniture out. You're going to save your furniture. Isn't that smart? I said, what do you mean? But 20 minutes ago, when the furniture was in the house and the lock was on the wall, you know, the furniture was in the house. It doesn't matter. It isn't tummy until the Kohen says so. Before he says so, it's not tummy. They even had a thing. If a person had it on his skin and it was Yom Tov, they wouldn't go to the Kohen until after Yom Tov because during Yom Tov, you don't want him to be tummy. So don't go to the Kohen. Because the Torah tells you to. Otherwise, you could avoid the whole thing. That's true. But the Torah tells you have to. Who knew the details of what? Who's they? Not the Kohen Gadol, any Kohen. Any Kohen. Five of them, do they know? This is taking the furniture out of the house. It's written in the Torah itself. Yeah. And this business not going to Yom Tov. The Gemara records it as one of the practices that they had. So I'm just saying, if you're looking for the concept of authority, so that's sort of like authority, although it's metaphysical, you're making it tell me, but it's sort of like that. But otherwise, Kohen don't have any particular authority, no. Which, by the way, another footnote, probably contrasts very strongly with other societies. Where the Kohanim, because they had magical powers and so on, you know, could manipulate things one way or another, by us. Kohen was a functionary. He had a job to do that nobody else could do, so he had to do the job, that's all. And if he doesn't want to do the job, you force him to do the job. Okay. Now, having said that we limit democracy in certain ways, let's reflect that democracy really reflects freedom. It really is an expression of freedom. Again, the root idea is don't push me around. Don't tell me what to do. So we try to give as much flexibility that each person can do what he wants. Okay, for the sake of cooperation, we're going to have to all agree. So we push around as few people as possible. But the root idea was don't push people around. Now, when you tell me we're going to have a representative democracy, and in between elections you can't have any input, so the government can push around 270 million people all at once, that's a gigantic loss of freedom. Oh, but we're all in favor of having more efficient decisions. Better decisions. More optimal decisions. Look what we're giving up. We're giving up freedom in order to have better decisions. Now, I'm in favor, but it's worth thinking about. You're giving up your freedom. You're accepting a system in which you can be grossly pushed around because you get better decisions that way. Well, you ought to reflect what that means about how you feel about freedom. Is freedom so very important? If freedom is so very important, then have elections on everything. People don't feel that that's really appropriate. So this also shows us that we're prepared to give up freedom for certain goals. Are you with me so far? Okay, test case. What should we say about exporting democracy to other countries? Is it obvious that democracy is the right way for every country to organize its society? Huh? What do you mean? Yeah, what would you have in its place? So here, probably the idea would be to say that they can't vote. You know, when Barack went to Washington and almost negotiated his terrible deal with that guy.
Trombley.
Yeah. And he swore he would only do it on a Jewish majority, and then one by one the MKs defeated him, deserted him. The majority that he had in Israeli Knesset was only on the basis of the Arab parties, which meant that a majority of Jews in the country were against giving up land. So in other words, but think of it. In other words, the government is giving away land against the majority view of the Jews in the country, because 10% of the people there are Arabs. So that's, you know, many people regard that as shocking. And at a certain point, they wanted to push through a law that the decision could only be made by 60%, which would mean you'd have to have at least 50% of the Jews. So you could, you know, then at least guarantee that you have a majority of Jews voting for something. But this is the problem you have. If you have a complete democracy, you have too many people on the inside who don't really care about the country, who don't really care about the future of the country, because they identify with people outside. If they could be the turning point in the election and in the policy, it's suicide.
Is Israel considered a democracy? When they say, like, it's a democracy, it's not really a democracy.
Why do you say that?
Well, if it was a democracy, like, we probably, if like, we walk within 50 feet of the Dome of the Rock, we probably wouldn't get killed, but we would. If we can't go anywhere we want, if we walk anywhere near there, they would kill us. In other words, they can walk right through the Kotel, right? So it's a democracy, but only as far as we're concerned. We're giving people freedom to do whatever they want, but...
I think here maybe you're putting together two ideas that really should be kept separate. The real idea of democracy is that the authority is with the people, right? No king is imposing his will on the people. No small group of noblemen is imposing their will on the people. We have an elected government, and the elected government takes decisions. The elected government has taken this decision to give these Arabs special privileges. Maybe it's a stupid decision, but I wouldn't say it's undemocratic. Because the majority here have done this, and I don't know if you could say that it's really immoral.
Where's the democracy in going somewhere where you might get killed. That's not democracy.
No, you got to get something straight. There are certain places in the United States, a government, where you can only go if you have security clearance. Right? Is that democratic? Aren't we all equal? Shouldn't we have all equal rights? Equal access? What do you mean? Now, I don't have a stamp on my identity papers, and I can't go into this room. Why can't I go into this room? Sir, you don't have security clearance. So what? The democracy. Fair and spirits, you know? I'm a human being. I'm an American citizen. My parents are American citizens. What are you telling me I can't go in for? Is it anti-democratic to stop a person and say you don't have security clearance?
Not really.
So democracy really means who makes the decisions, how are the decisions made. It doesn't really mean what decisions you make. It's how you make the decisions. That's why I said, the first thing I said yesterday, if 80% decide to kill out the other 20%, killing out the 20% is democratic. It is democratic. Because the majority have decided it. How you don't like it, that means at this point you say no to democracy. So what you can say here is, yes, a democratically elected government has decided to do this stupid thing. I'm against it because it's stupid, not because it's undemocratic. And if a majority in favor of it, then I'm against the majority because the majority is stupid. That doesn't make it undemocratic. Okay, now, the really tricky question, and I can't fully answer this question, is how should we feel as Torah Jews about democratic governance? First of all, as citizens in other countries, which are democratic countries, I don't know of any critique of non-Jewish countries that want to be democratic. They're more or less free to organize themselves as they please. Yes, they should abide by principles of justice, principles of morality, but how they decide to make their decisions, whether everybody gets a vote, whether they all take a vote on every issue, or a representative, or they have a king, or they have, you know. The Torah has not been against monarchies for non-Jewish countries. I don't think it's against democracies. I don't think it has any particular preference for one type of government or another type of government. Whatever they please is up to them. No, there. I'm talking about there now at the moment. How should an American Jew, a religious American Jew, feel about American democracy? Should he feel that it's an inherently illegitimate form of government, or it is legitimate, or I don't think he should have any opinion. It's up to the Americans to decide how they want to organize their lives. It's not up to us as Torah Jews to pass judgment on how they organize their lives. As far as the government in this country is concerned, it's very tricky. Obviously, the Jewish government in the land of Israel, if it isn't built on the principles of Torah, has no inherent validity whatsoever. There's no validity whatsoever. Oh yes, they have the guns. That's true. So you probably better stay out of their way. But legitimacy? In a certain sense, it's not a government. I, instead of trying to be elected, so what? We don't have democracy in our political sources at all. However, if you oppose the government in this country indirectly, you could be hurting other Jews, or maybe even directly. And then you have to be very careful. There is, for example, the question whether you have to pay your taxes to this government. One argument, I'm not saying yes or no, it's a very complicated issue, but one argument is, if you don't pay your taxes, then other Jews are going to have to pay more, so you are causing a loss to other Jews. Are you allowed to do that? It's not obvious. Not obvious the answer to that question. So, what I'm saying is you have to look at the government on two levels. One is government as government, and the other is government as an organization that's doing things And they do things for Jews and to Jews, and when you interact with them, you can have an effect on what they do for others. For example, voting in this country. If someone says, look, this is the government, and you're a citizen, and every citizen should vote, and you're going to have to vote, I think that's totally nonsense. But if somebody says, there's a group of people here, and they're running everybody's lives, and if you vote, and you have representatives, you can have an effect on the decisions that they make, and you can influence them to be better decisions, that's a different matter altogether. And that is why Agudas Israel, which is a political party in this country, and a religious movement all over the world, does have its representatives in the government, not because we recognize the government as a legitimate government, but it's a group of people with power and influence, and they're running our lives, and they're offering us an opportunity to have an input, so there's no reason why we shouldn't make use of that opportunity. Yeah.
And in the United States, does the APAC have that same kind of address, or are they concerned about Jews, about religious Jews here, or are they just concerned with political?
I don't think they have any particular concern with religious Jews, APAC. No. But there are religious lobby groups. Aguda has its own lobby efforts on Congress, on Capitol Hill, which is very well respected. Representatives of Aguda have met with presidents and with members of the legislature up and down the line. And they do lobby on behalf of the interests of religious Jews. And very visibly, with the yarmulkes on, and open to the press. So we definitely do take advantage of that. In Poland, in between the two world wars, Agudas Israel was a political party, and they had elected representatives to the Polish government. So, using the leverage that you have democratically is, I think, very important. Maybe one last thing, since we're talking about democracy, and we're talking about it. There is something you hear over and over again, and this is, again, one of these confusions, that the religious in Israel are, what's the right word? They're imposing their will on the majority. What a terrible thing to do. Imposing their will on the majority. They have control of the definition of who is a Jew and who isn't a Jew, and what marriages are recognized, and where people are buried, and personal status issues. And here you have a small minority, maybe 25 or 30% of the population, imposing its will on the majority, and it's all anti-democratic and terrible. Right? Now, this is similar to what you said before, but it's coming from the other side. These decisions are all made through a government, and the representatives of the government are elected by the people. Right? True, in this case, the decision follows the line of a small group of parties. But the majority has to agree to that. If they didn't agree to it, they could change it. I don't tell me the majority is only agreeing because they need this minority for their decisions. All democracy works that way. That's what in America's called log rolling. Right? You roll my log, I'll roll your log. Right? I'll vote for your bill, you vote for my bill. It's always done that way. There's nothing anti-democratic about it at all. All right, a representative democracy. It's another point I could have used yesterday also. I'm just thinking about it. In a representative democracy, even when the legislature votes, they don't have to vote according to what the majority of people want. They don't have to do that. And when they play games with each other, and they have different coalitions for each bill, so when you're building a coalition, and one group that you need says, but I need you on my vote, so when the next vote comes along, the position that's getting enacted is a position of 30%. Why? Because the other 25% needed them for their bill. So you'll have a series of minority measures, because otherwise you can't build coalitions. So you're not looking to the society at large and asking what a majority of people want. That's not how it works. How it works is building a majority inside the government. And that may mean, trading off things. That's certainly not anti-democratic. There couldn't be an anti-democratic government position in this country, or government policy in this country, because it's put into effect by a democratically elected government. So by definition, it's democratic. You might not like it, but you don't like what democracy did in this case. And we talked about that. But it can't be anti-democratic. Okay. Oh, I was looking at idols. No, I just meant it in quotation marks. I didn't mean to be idols. This is one that everybody will tell you. Democracy is the most important thing. So I've been looking about how important it is and how important it is not. Tomorrow we'll start with another one.